And welcome everyone to another Sunday evening here on peoplesinternetradio.com. I'm Stephen Robertson. This is Kensel Lacval. I've always liked to bring on my first guest. I'm not sure what's going to happen after the first hour, but he's only going to be with me for 1 hour. But I want to welcome back David Urith of Nova Institute of Technology. Welcome, David.
Hi, Stephen.
How are you today?
Well, we're in the middle of a blizzard, enjoying the weekend and relaxing before the week of madness before Christmas sets in tomorrow.
Yeah, I'd like to get some cold weather up here to maybe have winter. I don't know whether it's the geoengineering that's going on or whether there's some other type of abnormality that's keeping us from having a winter this year. But at least some places are having one anyways. But Christmas time, you happened to mention just the other day in a text that there's going to be some new things coming out in 2016. Some new toys in that?
Well, some new toys, some new technologies, some new materials. 2016 is going to be a banner year for Nova and for lots of people out there in the technology innovation world. There's some pretty exciting stuff on the horizon.
Fantastic. Hopefully Santa will be good to all the little girls and boys and give us some new toys, right?
We certainly hope so. We certainly do hope so.
So what's going on in the region of alternative science and alternative energies and that?
Well, we've been doing some interesting things this year on our side of the equation. I thought as a matter of interest, at the end of the year, I could do a little bit of a summary of where we've been during the year and where it looks like we're going to be heading in the year that's coming up.
And what does that entail?
Well, let's see. Early in the year, we began talking about a new technology that we've been developing. It's actually been in development since 2008. But in 2015, put together a combination of new technologies and new materials, some new electronics, and a new conceptual model that enables us to dissociate carbon dioxide and all the other exhaust gases that are produced by an internal combustion engine. In fact, reduce to elemental substances virtually all of the exhaust products of burning anything. We've had some pretty interesting success with that during the past year. The technology is evolving much more quickly than we had anticipated. And, we've been watching the Global Climate Change Conference and related events that give us some idea about the severity of the issues that are produced by exhaust emissions. Today in Beijing, for the third time, they're issuing a red alert that stops everything in the city. No transportation, no burning. People are ordered to stay indoors because the quality of the air in Beijing and the surrounding areas is so toxic that it's killing people. This is the third time since September that the Chinese government has done this, and we now see it occurring in a number of other cities. Announcements of the same thing happening in Moscow. We see it happening on a somewhat more regular basis in Mexico City. So major population areas all over the world are now suffering so extensively from air pollution that's the result of automobile exhaust that there just aren't any alternatives. So we're pretty excited about being able to take this technology into the world. We're in the process of putting together some affiliate relationships with people in other countries so that we can take this technology into the market in big numbers in ways that we think will really make a difference. So we're pretty excited about that. We had an opportunity to go on another couple of radio shows earlier in the year, spent a couple of hours on Coast to Coast and on Zoomer Radio in Toronto, and we're really deluged by inquiries and really congratulatory support email from people all over the world. It's really been a lot of fun to meet so many really wonderful people in that way. But we're having a good time with the technology. the idea that we can retrofit existing transportation platforms with a relatively inexpensive system that will turn their exhaust into elemental gases and water vapor and recoverable nanoparticulates of carbon, which are not harmful to human beings, is a really exciting undertaking. And we're going to be seeing these technologies expanded. Now, we've been working to develop adaptations of the technology to such important things as coal-fired power plants. We have a number of initiatives now underway elsewhere in the world to adapt the CO2 dissociation technology to the burning of coal in power plants. In the provinces of Canada, for example, and in the United States more particularly, there's so much pressure being brought to eliminate coal as a source of fuel to produce power. Most of the pressure is political. It has to do with who takes political preference in the marketplace. And the natural gas guys are in ascendancy lately. Cost of oil has begun to limit their cost effectiveness in the production of natural gas as part of the fracking process. But there's still a lot of activity out there. There's such abundant supply that the prices of these commodities are falling every day.
Tell me something, David. The rumor is that the reason the gas price is so low here in the last, 6 to 8 months is because of that fracking. Maybe they're trying to limit the fracking and keep the industry out of
it. It's possible. The Saudis have increased production, notwithstanding the fact that there's a huge glut on the market. There are a couple of reasons for that. Not the least of which is that their economies have become addicted to the revenues that come from oil production because that's the only thing they have to export. And rather than allow fracking practices that are practices in the oil sands of Canada, for example, to encroach on their market share, the Saudis have basically thumbed their nose at the world and said, we're going to produce as much oil as it takes to maintain our revenue stream at least a nominal level. And they've been doing that. I mean, a year ago, Brent crude was at $139 a barrel. Yesterday, it was $37.84. So, you know, the Saudis continue to produce more and more oil. Most of the independently owned oil production companies that were relying on fracking in the United States have gone out of business. If they haven't gone out of business, they've at least begun to limit their production because it costs 50 to 60 bucks a barrel, best case, to produce refinable crude using the fracking methodology. So they can't make any money when it's only 40 bucks a barrel or less. They know this isn't going to last forever, but right now there are mountains of drilling pipe stacking up in the plains of Texas and the Midwest. Texas Commerce Bank Tower has a higher vacancy rate than they've had since that thing was built 15, 20 years ago. So, and we're seeing the same thing in the provinces of Canada. You know, the vacancy rate for office space in Calgary is at its lowest point in history because the demand for oil and the price for crude has now dropped below a threshold that is sustainable. And this is what creates an opportunity for a couple of more technologies that we're very excited about. We've teamed up with some colleagues of ours to develop some technologies that give us a way to generate electrical power in a way that burns no fuel and which is infinitely sustainable, at least as long as the sun shines on the planet. One of the big challenges of the fracking world is what to do with the wastewater that is pumped back up out of the hole once they've begun the process. And the practice in recent years has been to take the backwash, the frack water, put it in big trucks, take it to empty oil wells, dry wells all over the Midwest, and pump it down the hole. That practice has resulted in the increase in earthquakes across the Midwest, particularly in Oklahoma, by several orders of magnitude. In 2015 alone, there were recorded more than 5,000 detectable earthquakes in Oklahoma, where before there had been maybe 50 for the prior 100 years. So the practices is being regulated means that there's an opportunity now to find some other ways to deal with this frack water. And colleagues of ours have developed a technology which takes the frack water, eliminates the particulates and the colloids and all of the volatile organic chemicals, and produces clean, crisp, bright, pure brine. Now, the fracking industry can't use the brine because it's already saturated with ionic salt, sodium chloride in particular. But we've devised a way, working together, to dig reservoirs that are 15 to 20 feet deep and line them with a membrane and insulate them and cover them with various concentrations of refined, polished brine generated by fracking water processing. And what we've discovered is that the bottom layer of these ponds holds the heat that's generated by the sun. Radiant heat is absorbed in the lower layers, and the upper layers insulate them so that the heat doesn't escape. And we've developed an engine that, even though this temperature is not high enough to boil water to create steam, it is nevertheless hot enough to drive a number of different kinds of what we call phase change fluids, like freon. We can use the temperature from the bottom of these ponds, constantly refreshed by the sunlight. In effect, it's a huge thermal battery, and we can convert that heat into shaft horsepower that can be used to pump and refine and filter and drive generators to produce electric power. So after our experimental work and after all the work that we've done in the past year on this technology, what we know is that a 5-acre pond, 20 feet deep, properly prepared and supported, once you get it all put together and get it operating, will produce more than 20 megawatts of electrical power 24/7 on demand every day of the year.
20 million watts a day?
20 megawatts on demand 24/7 without burning a single drop of fuel.
Well, what's a megawatt then?
It's a million watts.
Okay, that's what I thought.
It's enough power to power
medium-sized city, isn't it?
35 to 50,000 homes.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Like a small to a medium-sized city, yeah.
And what that means is that in the interim, while the world is learning how to transition away from fossil fuels and petroleum and natural gas and has given up the temptation to engage in the suicidal practice of nuclear power production, we can introduce an alternative that burns no fuel at all. It creates no waste product at all, and it is infinitely sustainable and replenished by sunshine every day. And in places where the sunshine is seasonal, but where there is wind, we've re-engineered wind turbines so that instead of producing electricity, they produce heat. And we use that heat to replenish the heat in the salt ponds so that in the early morning and the late afternoon, when power is not needed at such a high rate, but when the wind blows, the ponds get reheated. And in the middle of the day, when power is needed for air conditioners and other kinds of high demand use, we can draw on those ponds to supply power regionally or locally or in distribution through the conventional grid process. So this is a brand new technology, and it's really exciting because what it means is that in all the populated areas of the world where they have lots of sunshine and access to salty water, which is all the 6,000 island nations in the middle of the world and all of the desert nations that border onto the oceans where there is no fuel, we can take salt water and refine it. We can concentrate it and put it into properly engineered reservoirs and use it to store the radiant heat from the sun and use that heat to drive all of the domestic and commercial and industrial requirements that are part of satisfying the growth of population's need for energy. It's a very exciting technology, and we're taking it into the world. We've got several projects now where we're, you know, driving this stuff into actual operation. We've got lots of partners. People in the frack world are pretty excited about it because it gives them a way to dispose of the wastewater that is an incidental part of their process and do it in a way that really satisfies the equation. So we're pretty excited about that technology. The technology we've developed to convert this lower temperature thermal value into electric power is another technology that has extensive applications in lots of places all over the world. So we're pretty excited about these things because they do what the recent Paris Climate Conference did not do. What the Conference on Climate Change absolutely and utterly demonstrated is that there is no will among the nations of the world to actually solve the problem.
Yeah, there's too many special interest corporations and too many people that have a big interest in some of these things failing.
A number of technologies have been proposed to reduce the carbon dioxide content in the environment. All of them operate on the basis of a principle that says you have to deal with CO2 after it's been produced and released into the environment. And that's nuts. Once the feathers are in the wind, they cannot be recovered, period. So people want to put dust in the upper atmosphere like a volcano to keep the atmosphere cool. And they want to do it with all kinds of cockamamie chemicals without regard to what those chemicals do when they come back into the environment at the surface. There are people who want to pour gazillions of gallons of hydrochloric acid into the ocean to impede the rate at which the ocean can absorb CO2 without doing anything at all about the 30 million tons of carbon dioxide that's produced every day all over the planet that goes into solution, that acidifies the oceans, that is now killing the coral reefs, which lie at the heart of the food chain. Nobody at that conference, none of the science that was introduced, does anything at all to eliminate the production of carbon dioxide except by limiting the extent to which power is produced to support human requirements. And what you really have now is a huge political and economic war in which those who use fuel to satisfy the needs for power in the world are now being pitted against those who are trying to regulate the production of power using the pretext of climate change as the reason for regulating them out of existence or capitalizing on their profit margins. Nobody is addressing the issue of how do you not produce carbon dioxide without putting the planet and all of the biosphere at risk. Well, we know how to do it, and we are doing it, and we're going to do it.
Well, David, do you think, I'm all for limiting the carbon dioxide and the methane that gets put up into the atmosphere and that, but how about stopping the deforestation of the entire planet? That would have to help. That would have to help.
Yeah. You know, as long as the fast food burger joints continue to successfully denude the rainforest at the rate of a million acres a year, exposing nutrient-poor soils on which they are able to range their cattle for less than 3 years. Then they go in and repopulate that stuff with palm so they can process the palm into palm oil, so they can go out and try to repopulate the planet with a new kind of fuel source, which continually produces exhaust in the form of carbon dioxide and other pollutants.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
It's just insane.
The deforestation industry, they've studied this for years. They can build little tree. I'm trying to think of the specific word. Tree farms. There are tree farms out in the state of Washington. I've seen them. They might be 5 or 10 acres, and the trees are very, very close to each other, like within just inches, and it looks like just hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, or if not thousands of trees inside of a couple of acres. And
well, the fact of the matter is that when it's in balance in the natural order of things, the natural systems produce carbon dioxide in a way that is an essential requirement for photosynthesis.
Yes.
So some of the specious arguments that are post or that are asserted by people who are in resistance to solving the problem for whatever reason is that you can't be worried about producing carbon dioxide because it's the natural stuff that the planet relies on. And it's a stupid argument, and it's disingenuous, because the fact of the matter is we're overproducing carbon dioxide and methane gas, which is 25 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2 ever was. We're doing that at a rate that alters the balance, that tips it over, that threatens the food chain at its source. So, you know, we know there are going to be big winners and there are going to be big losers in the carbon dioxide remediation game, and we can't afford to care
which
is which.
That's just what I was going to get to.
We can't afford to care about that.
Why should we care who wins and loses?
Look, what we care about is that we're being driven to extinction by our own profligate consumption of fossil fuels and petroleum fuels and waste dumps. The municipal landfills of North America produce more methane than any other source on the planet. Look, there are 15 ships at sea whose exhaust exceeds the amount of carbon dioxide produced by all the automobiles of the world put together. And there are hundreds of them out there, not just 15.
Shipping vessels, you mean?
Yes, sir. Big oil tankers, big natural gas tankers, it's nuts. It just doesn't make any sense. So what we've decided we're going to do, and we are doing it, is to take the technology and the science and build proof of concept demonstration prototypes which prove that the technology, which we've already successfully applied and demonstrated to automobile and truck exhaust, is extensible so that it will also remediate all the exhaust gases produced by coal, by methane combustion, in pyrolysis, in bioincinerators, by ships at sea, and by virtually every other known means, including coking gas, which is essential to the steel industry. So, you know, the consequences of the technology are really far-reaching because they actually eliminate the production of carbon dioxide and other noxious gases that are outside the balance of the natural order.
Are there patents for all of these technologies?
Sure. Yes, we've applied for patents, and some of them have already been noticed for issue. We own the technology. We own the devices. We own the concepts. We've defined them with our own publications, which have all been filed as open source documents on the internet. So, you know, we're in that place where we're being transparent, we're being assertive, we're driving very aggressively towards certain points of demonstration and application. We've got wonderful partners, and we're very excited about what's coming down the road. Go ahead.
What's it going to take to get marketing and advertising and funding?
That's really the easy part, actually.
Yeah.
and our business plan is pretty straightforward. You know, you can't be good at everything. And Nova Institute of Technology and its partners, its science and technology partners, are really, really good at innovation that requires the integration of technologies, new and old and emerging. We do prototypes, we do testing, we do data gathering, we do instrumentation. We're really good at the science of this. And the patents that we've been granted, we were able to get a patent issued, noticed for issue in less than 13 months from the date of filing for the basic technology that makes this possible. That's got to be some kind of a world record in the modern era. I mean, the last time we tried to get a patent, it cost us $85,000 and took 7.5 years. In this case, because the technology is brand new, because the science is really revolutionary, because the integration does not exist elsewhere on the planet in the way we've described it, we didn't have to fight any wars over our patent. They issued the patent, noticed the patent for issue, by granting all of our claims. All. So we're pretty excited about that because it means we own the waterfront now on what we're doing and how we're doing it. And the reason we're doing it is because we got to figure out how to solve the problem. So we have good good relationships with media and public relations people because some of our principals are senior executives from the media and advertising world. We have people that we work with who are former senior executives with the networks. We have people who are, you know, former presidents and senior executives of some of the biggest technology companies in Silicon Valley, commercial companies like Procter & Gamble and Pepsi-Cola and Ryder Truck and Squibb Laboratories. We've got some really special people who are part of our team. And because we have great people on our team, we're able to engineer relationships for manufacturing, for the supply side components, for component assembly, for the technology and the high-tech materials that we use under the terms of licensing agreements that operate in a way that really is wonderful for everybody that participates. And we're in the process now and have been for some time putting the relationships together with our strategic partners so that we can move from the laboratory into the marketplace in a way that makes this technology available and indispensable so that it becomes irresistible despite whatever resistance may be mounted by people who don't want this technology to be part of the world. And we are getting some resistance, and that's fine. We expected it. We're prepared for it. We know what to do about it. We don't want to make any enemies. We don't want to be at war, but we're not going to let anybody keep us from doing what we're doing. So, you know, it's pretty well calculated.
Well, that's good. That's good. As I've told you many times, I want to be the big part of any type of a movement that will, you know, stop feeding this beast. If I can.
Well, so do we. And there are lots of people who do. I mean, we've gotten literally hundreds of emails in the last 5 or 6 weeks from people all over the planet who have been so excited about what we're doing that they just had to, you know, let us know that they were out there, that they're listening, that they're hopeful, that they're supportive. Some of those people who contacted us are really important people. We were contacted by the folks from Volkswagen 3 days after their catastrophic announcement about cheating on emissions testing in their diesel engines. We don't know whether we'll ever end up doing any business with Volkswagen, but they contacted us first, and they're not the only ones. So, you know, we've been gratified by the response that we've gotten from people, and we're content to manage this process in a way that seems to be manageable and constructive and forward-looking, you know, with the help of our friends at Dandelion Books. Carol Adler, who is the chairman of the board of Nova, is also the owner and founder of Dandelion Books, and she published a couple of books for me, for Nova, that are really important. You know, we're aware, because we've been in the trenches for many decades, we're old guys, and we've got all the teeth marks and all the t-shirts that people get when they try to get into the world of innovation and get caught by the dragon in one way or another. We know what happens out there in the world. We're not naive or innocent anymore. So in order to make sure that people understand who we are and how we go about the business of managing innovation, wrote and published a book called The Ho Chi Minh Guerrilla Warfare Handbook. It's a strategic guide to innovation management. It's a lot of fun. We were getting our heads handed to us by the Department of Energy after we figured out how to eliminate radioactive emissions produced by spent high-level nuclear fuel. They threatened to arrest us as terrorists under FISA unless we stopped remediating nuclear waste. Well, we thought that's a problem that people would want to fix. Apparently, the people at the Department of Energy don't agree with that.
No, they don't.
At least the contractors that run the agency don't agree with it. So,
were they thinking that you might be trying to make nuclear materials or something?
But we know very well now what the real agenda is.
Yes.
And that's, you know, we've had that conversation.
Eugenics.
But in any event, you know, it occurred to me that we've been doing battle with all the same multinational forces that Ho Chi Minh did battle with during the Vietnam conflict. Nobody gave that guy a snowflake's chance in a boiler of being able to successfully integrate North and South Vietnam even after they defeated the French and drove them out of their country. And the United States and other political interests decided for a number of different reasons that they were bound and determined to prevent that from happening. And there were a lot of other agendas that were part of that scenario. But Ho Chi Minh sent them packing 10 years later with their tail between their legs. And it occurred to me that, you know, if he could do that with a sharpened bamboo stick and a stolen rifle, maybe there was hope for us. So we read everything there was to read about the guy, discovered that there was a good reason why during the 10 years of the Vietnam conflict, Time magazine named him the Man of the Year 4 times. He's the only guy in the history of that publication that was awarded that honor 4 times. And there was a good reason, because he knew things we don't know, and he thought about conflict in ways that we never consider.
Well,
so we took all that information.
Yeah.
We put it all together in a great little book. You can buy it on Amazon. You can buy it direct from Dandelion Publishing for less money. We're in the process of doing the audio book and hope to get that ready by the end of the first quarter of next year. But if you go to www.dandelion-books.com, you can buy the book direct from Dandelion, and you can figure out by reading that book why we're doing what we're doing, the way we're doing it, with our strategic development approach to putting our products in the market. So, you know, it's an exercise. There are some other new technologies that are coming into the world that we think are equally exciting. Back in 2005, a friend of mine, Don Ayers, a really brilliant and lovely man, part of the NASA mission specialist community that put the rockets into space and sent men to the moon and put the space shuttle up and down so many times safely. Don's one of these guys who really understands things from the inside out, and we connected in 2003. And over a period of a couple of years, by collaborating and sorting through 100 years of research information, we were able to create a brand new model of fine-scale physical interactions. And we published that model open source on the internet in 2005 under the title Y-Bias and Angularity. And if you go on Google or any of the search engines, you'll see that you get several million hits on that title. People are using it now in peer-reviewed papers, quoting it, relying on it, giving attribution to it in scientific work all over the world. What we've been able to do, because we reinvented the model by looking at how nature works from the inside out rather than from the outside in, as suggested by this stupid notion called the Big Bang model of the universe, we've been able to invent some new materials. We've been able to understand some processes. We've been able to get a grip on how nature works from a different point of view, and it's because of the conceptual basis provided in that model and in other research materials that we're now in the process of publishing with Dandelion Books and a book called Seeing Past the Edge. All that science, all the concepts, the underlying rules that take place when information is organized to create the universe we live in, if you understand how all those rules work, then you can engineer your reality, which is the reason we are able to figure out how to dissociate carbon dioxide and other exhaust molecules before they get out the end of the exhaust pipe. And if we hadn't had that science available to us, which is not available to other people who are tied to traditional scientific dogma, if you can't step out of that box and look at the science from a new point of view, you can't figure out how to solve the problem. And well, much of the resistance we're getting is from people who say, well, it just can't be done. It's just not possible. Well, it is possible. Not only possible now, it's been possible since 2008, when we very first demonstrated that it would work. And we're now 7 years along, and what we're doing now works orders of magnitude better than it did 8 years ago. And we're taking it to the marketplace. So all of this stuff is made possible, Stephen, because people like you have the courage to maintain a commitment to take information that really is informative to people out in the world who really want to know what they can do to solve the fundamental problems. We've dedicated our lives and all of our resources to figuring out how stuff works so we can apply that information to solving these big problems.
Well, I would like to know, David, how long it would take for me to go out there to Utah to have to stay to get my car converted over and to be able to.
Well, we'll bring you out here next summer and we'll plug you in. We've got a series of technologies that are so cool. They operate on both ends of the equation.
All right.
We applied for a patent for a new kind of spark plug that operates with a new kind of electronics that combusts virtually 100% of the fuel that passes through the engine while it's operating.
Hey, you mentioned that you won't even need a catalytic converter anymore, will you?
Well, you know, we're not producing at least very little uncombusted fuel. You still get carbon dioxide. You still get a little bit of carbon monoxide. You get mostly NO2, not NOx. With most of the fuels, you get a little bit of sulfur dioxide because there's always a little bit of sulfur in there. But by and large, you're able to burn fuel so much more efficiently that you can more than double your mileage. Your engine runs cooler because it combusts the fuel more efficiently, because the electronics work more efficiently. So our friends at SavvyCorp in California have spent the last 15 years building a family of automotive products that clean up all the blow-by gases that go into the crankcase while your engine's running. And by evacuating those gases in a vacuum and then reprocessing them using a microcontroller system, engines that are equipped with a combination of the DynoValve technologies and our spark plug technologies are spectacular. They're just spectacular. And on the back end of the equation, we apply a module inside the exhaust system that dissociates all of the gases of every kind that come out of that ignition process, so that all you get out of the tailpipe is elemental nanocarbon. It's mostly graphene and water vapor and oxygen gas and nitrogen gas and other gases. We put them back into the atmosphere and back into the natural system in a way that is naturally absorbable and that supports and sustains and remediates a sustainable environment. There are lots of people that are saying, well, you don't want to do that because that means people can burn as much gas as they want. Well, they can. And if they can, and that helps to contribute to the way the human part of the equation can occupy the planet without contaminating it, we're real happy to do that. At some point, we know that what Elon Musk and Tesla Motors have begun is going to transition us away from burning fossil fuels and petroleum to self-recharging electric vehicles.
Who is the first name you mentioned there?
Elon Musk is the guy who created Tesla Motors. He's the guy that created SpaceX. He's the guy that's participating with Sir Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos and a number of other gazillionaires to try to find a way to commercialize space exploration and mining in space. You know, young guys with deep pockets, with big visions about doing things out in space.
Yeah, allegedly.
And that's fine. You know, they've got the money and they want to go do that, and it's perfectly fine for them to do it.
Allegedly, there's more gold in asteroids than what there is on the Earth.
Well, maybe there is.
Well, that's why I said
maybe there is.
But allegedly,
there are technologies that have yet to be brought to commercial application that operate in a way that will have a dramatic impact in the very near future on the way gold is mined. And that's another conversation. We're deeply involved in the creation of new technologies using new concepts that will enable us to process indigenous minerals like gold and platinum and other things in ways that were never possible before. We got some stuff working in the laboratory that's pretty exciting, and we're not at liberty to talk about it yet, but we will. But the point I was going to make is that within a matter of two or three generations, people won't need to burn gasoline anymore anyway. Elon Musk today produces a glorified golf cart, and it uses batteries that require resupply by being plugged in and recharged in a grid that's powered by coal and nuclear power and natural gas and some sustainable energy sources. We're in the process, working with others, of developing technologies of a number of different kinds that will enable electric cars to be self-recharging, which means that you'll never have to stop driving till your foot falls off, and you never have to stop and plug them in because the power sources sustain themselves.
Is that kind of like a perpetual motion car?
No, it's not a perpetual motion machine at all. Look, we've got in our records more than a dozen patents that have already been issued for technologies and pieces of equipment that, once turned on, sustain and power themselves without any extrinsic input. They don't burn any fuel. Those patents have long since expired, but we understand how those technologies work. They're heat exchangers. There's nothing exotic about them, but when you understand how natural forces really operate from the inside out, then you get to engineer applications that do that in a way that make them useful. So on the Nova website, which you can find at www.novaiot.com, there is a toggle at the top of the right-hand corner that says Technologies. And in that technology page, we've listed 5 dozen technologies that are all things that we're involved in, have patents for, have mutually designed and built and demonstrated by ourselves and with our friends in the technology world. And in that list, there's a category called self-sustaining engine technologies. And in that list, there are a dozen different kinds of technologies that we know, because we've designed and built and demonstrated them in our own labs or with other people, that operate on their own without extrinsic fuel sources and are self-sustaining, and they produce no exhaust. This is not new. It's been around for a long, long time.
So somebody could have one in a basement or something then, couldn't they?
You can have it in a basement. You can have it in your car. You can have it in your neighborhood. You can have it in an island community. You can do all kinds of things. There's no silver bullet. But one of these days, Elon Musk's $100,000 golf cart is going to become a vehicle that operates on its own all the time, every time, without burning any fuel. And we're deeply involved in the development of technologies that facilitate that objective. We're going there.
Why hasn't anyone created a perpetual motion machine to date so far?
They have.
Have they?
Of course they have. I mean, as early as the 17th century. If you go on Google and you look at a Google search that looks for the Besseler engine, B-E-S-E-L-E-R, Besseler engine, you'll find accounts impeccably documented of a young guy who built a wheel that, once he began turning it, continued to turn itself until a whole bunch of people figured out how to stop it. The Besseler wheel is a matter of record, and people have been trying for 300 years to figure out how to replicate it. It operates on very natural principles. All he had was cast iron and wood. He didn't have bearings. He didn't have technologies. He didn't have gears and all of the things that we use in engines. It took him a week to build it in a woodshed, and he put it on the back of a wagon drawn by horses. And it worked. It made a lot of noise, and it worked. In the 30s, Bob Neal built an engine that ran on compressed air. And we've kind of talked about that story in prior programs. Well, the Bob Neal engine is a heat exchanger. He did 2 important things that we now understand. We've replicated it. I published on PES Wiki, on Sterling Allen's Pure Energy Systems Wiki site, the parts list, the instructions, the science, the schematics, the drawings, everything you need to build one. So you want to build a self-sustaining engine that runs on compressed air, all you got to do is go to Sterling Allen's website and get the parts list and make it. It's not a big mystery. We've got a dozen of them, and some of them are much more exciting than others. But the point I'm trying to make is that in the very near future, we won't have to worry so much about carbon dioxide, because we won't need to burn stuff at such a prodigious rate. So, you know, there's exciting stuff coming. We're looking forward to 2016. We've had a very interesting and exciting year in 2015. We've got a new website, NovaIoT.com. Your listeners are welcome to go there. If they want to contact us, they can do that on the contact toggle. We've got some wonderful partners. We want to thank our friends in Canada and Australia, and our friends here in the United States among the science community, people that we've worked with whose technologies and whose work and effort and commitment are just spectacular. We're really excited about being able to specifically address a whole bunch of problems that are fundamental. And the CO2 greenhouse gas issue is one that we've decided is at the top of our list of priorities, and we're going to take that baby on, and we're going to make a difference. And that's just all there is to it.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant stuff, David. It really is. And a lot of people say it's courageous, but I don't know about courage or whatever, you know. It just, having enough of the system and being able to want to change, I think, is what a lot of people are seeking.
Well, we've got some new products that we'll be coming out with next year. We've designed a new radiation detector. Millennial helicopter moms will be able to buy a little thing that looks like a flashlight. And they can go to their local grocery store and point it at Norwegian salmon, and if it's radioactively contaminated, it'll light up, and they don't buy it. And they do that to make sure that the food they buy is not radioactively contaminated beyond a point at which it's safe to consume. People have been asking us for this, and so we designed it, and we're engaged in a dialogue now with Homeland Security about how to make that available to a whole bunch of people in a lot of different applications. So
they're not going to care about that, though.
Well, they don't care about that, but they care about the Coast Guard, and they care about people at TSA, and they care about people who are in the government service who are engaged in activities that sometimes take them into radioactively contaminated environments. We've developed a brand new technology that's wickedly cool. It's 100 times more sensitive than a Geiger counter at 1/20th the cost. We're very excited about it, and we're coming.
Well, brilliant stuff. Anything else here in the last couple of minutes here?
Not really, Stephen. I just want to say thank you again for, you know, being invited to participate with you on your program. You've been so gracious, and it's been such fun to be able to talk with your listeners about what we're doing, to help them understand what's coming, to let them know that there are resources available to help them get their questions answered, and that, you know, there's a reason, a genuine reason, to be optimistic and hopeful that the catastrophic issues that have been precipitated on natural systems by human profligate behavior are not hopeless. Can't fix it.
That's the key right there, though, David. Breaking through to people, breaking through to people's conditioning and programming to try to break the cycle, because
I'm an old guy, man. I've got some time left. I don't know how much.
Yeah, but you're not a statist, though.
I'm certainly on the downside of the equation, and senior guys like me lived long enough to know that places in nature where we used to go when we were young are not pristine places in nature anymore.
They're changed, yes.
And I don't like that, and I don't have to put up with it.
No.
And I'm too old to worry about whether anybody gives a damn.
That's right. None of us have to put up with it.
So, you know, we've got good people that have banded together, who are determined, who are absolutely and utterly committed to making a difference, so that those who come after us, our children and our grandchildren, will be able to breathe clean air and drink clean water and be in a place that is not radioactively contaminated, so that nature can recover. We're going to do it. We're making it happen. And it's thanks to you that your listeners have an opportunity to learn about this, because without you, we wouldn't have a way to talk to them.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I've already put your website in there, Nova IoT, and NovaIoT.com, and Dandelion-Books.com.
Well, they've been wonderful to work with, and our friends at SavvyCorp in California have been exceptionally good partners, and we're on the brink of doing some really exciting things, and we're just going to rest up during the holidays, so we've got a full tank of gas, and we can get after it after the first of the year.
And you'll have to put me in touch with some of these people that are going to be getting you some funding.
Well, we'll do that for sure.
I'm looking for funding myself. I want to build a studio so I can do this professionally.
Well, you're doing a great job, and I appreciate your support, and I know people listen to you, and we post these conversations on the Dandelion website, and they get visited with considerable regularity all the time. So, you know, we'll find a way to get the word out.
Okay. Thanks again, David.
Thank you, Stephen. Have a good new year.
And you too.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. All right, everybody. I am deadbeat tonight. I'm gonna cut this show off an hour early. I've got some things to do here with this video that I'm just gonna finish up here. I had David on the video there, so I'm gonna make it into a YouTube video, and I didn't really have anybody else coming on tonight, so I'm just gonna make it a 1 hour show, and if anybody wants to stream for a ninja, they are welcome to it. So I want to say it's been a good Sunday night show here. I like having David on, so thanks everybody for staying up, and the stream will be available here in just a few minutes for a ninja. I'm Stephen Roberts, and this has been Cancel the Cabal on peoplesinternetradio.com. Have a good night, everyone.